Well, welcome to our Academy session here at Christ Reformed Church. I'm glad you could come out tonight and be with us. Our topic is, I hope, a helpful and unique one to you. I'm going to try to present some of these ideas in a very different context, and that is, I'm going to talk about them in very personal terms. What would it be like if you could actually have lunch with one of your favorite Christian figures of the past? That would be interesting, I think, to be able to ask them questions or to know what they were like personally. So I'm going to present this material that I've presented in various contexts. I'm going to try to present it in a bit of a more personal way. And so that's kind of the context in which we'll be doing it. But let's talk a little bit about St. Augustine. And that kind of brings us to our statement about him. I think that he is not only the last of the Church Fathers. Remember that the era of the Church Fathers is, depending on when you begin it, it's 300 or 400 years, maybe closer toward three. But I think Augustine is the greatest of all the Church Fathers, and I'm not alone in stating that. What I mean by that is, I think the level of sophistication with St. Augustine goes way up, and I think that Augustine is a systematizer. He's the first one to kind of put a lot of these ideas together. So he is one of those individuals that is respected as a church father. And I've always said that I wish Protestant Christians could have a greater appreciation of the church fathers. They don't belong exclusively to the Roman Catholic Church. And certainly the Eastern Fathers didn't belong to the Catholic Church. They belonged in the East. I think that Augustine is not only the last, but I think he's the most capable. And his theological system is more persuasive in many ways. So though Christianity has produced many prominent thinkers, and I emphasize many, during the past 2,000 years, Augustine may be the most influential Christian thinker of all time outside the New Testament. I mean, that's I'm saying a lot there. I'm going out on the limb there, but I actually think I'm right. Especially when you consider his competition. Let's look at his competition with regard to Catholicism. Probably his greatest competitor as an influential thinker would be the great medieval Catholic theologian Thomas Aquinas. But I'll bet if you had lunch with Thomas Aquinas, which is another date in the future for us, I think if you had lunch with Thomas Aquinas and you ask him, who's the great Christian thinker of all time, I think Thomas's answer would be, outside of the New Testament, outside of Paul, it would be Augustine. And I know that Anselm would say something similar to that as well. Now, how about his Protestant competition? Well, what order was Luther in? He was in the Augustinian order. And what about Calvin? Well, how many times does Calvin quote Luther? About 100 times. How many times does Calvin quote Augustine? 2,400 times. Now, does that mean that Calvin always agreed more with Augustine than Luther? No, it doesn't. My answer to that is this. I think Calvin was trying to persuade the Catholic Church that the intellectual firepower in the Roman tradition actually sided with them. So they were both appealing to Augustine in some sense. Now, of course, does that mean Augustine was never wrong? No. Remember, he is an advocate of original sin. And there's no way that he would ever want anyone to think of him as somehow perfect. In fact, his last book was called what? Does anybody remember what his last book was entitled? Retractions. I'm hoping not to write one of those myself. But there are people who think I ought to begin writing it now. Augustine realized that he had made some mistakes, and maybe he had misled people, and he was trying to come to grips with all of that. So in many ways, I think that he was a very humble man. There are people who raise questions about him. And the last lecture, I'm going to look at what I think is the strongest criticism that's brought to bear against Augustine. And I'm not going to tell you what that is just yet. But I'm going to look at one where scholars are very critical of him. Now, there are other things. I had a fellow even today say to me that Augustine he had issues with women. And I'm not quite sure what he meant by that. Before Augustine became a Christian, he had a big problem with his sexuality. I think, though, the fellow that was communicating that is kind of giving a postmodern criticism that maybe St. Augustine would not look at a woman's authority in the church the same way some people would in our own time. So I think that you could make a powerful case that Augustine's influence may rank him number one. That influence, especially on Western Christianity, is directly tied to his profound work as a theologian, as a philosopher, as an apologist, and a church bishop. Now, Augustine isn't technically a philosopher. Does anybody remember the field that he's trained in? What is his specialty? Does anybody recall? He is a rhetorician. He's a lawyer. He's training to persuade people, and so he would be in the legal and the rhetorical tradition. But he may be the most influential philosopher because he engages with all kinds of issues. I think it's also important to recognize that how does he get all this work done? Because he is a bishop, and being a bishop involves a lot of work. It is not easy to hold the position that he does in an ecclesiastical context and then write all of the books that he does. He writes more than 5 million words. Let me give you an explanation. If you've ever seen my book Without a Doubt, that's about 100,000 words. So how many Without a Doubts would get you to 5 million? You'd have to write more than 50. And this is not at a time when writing is easy. It's expensive. There's no Xerox copier in the church basement. This is a difficult time, but he is a great writer. I was talking earlier, and I was saying maybe the question that I would have for St. Augustine at lunch would be, how do you survive in North Africa in the summertime with no air conditioning? I mean, we're talking about one of the hottest places on earth, and yet he thrives there. Probably they didn't do a lot of work during the day. They would be very careful not to go out into the sun. His theological and philosophical views significantly influenced other great Roman Catholic thinkers, as Saint Anselm. Anselm is a student of Augustine. Anselm takes some of Augustine's philosophical ideas and develops them. Thomas Aquinas, arguably the most intelligent Christian to ever live. That's a big statement, but I think I could make that case. Thomas is absolutely brilliant, but I'll bet you if you ask Thomas, who's the greatest Christian thinker, he might defer to St. Augustine, which is an amazing thing. Blaise Pascal, another brilliant mathematician, physicist, also an apologist, is influenced by Augustine. There's a story that Pascal, at 39 years old, came down with something like stomach cancer. And he had a huge library. He came from a very wealthy family. And he gave away his entire library except for two books, his Bible and his copy of the Confessions. So Pascal was an admirer of Augustine. Luther, Calvin, the great Anglican theologian, Thomas Cranmer as well, was a student of Augustine. Augustine was also an incredibly prolific classical author, with his surviving works comprising just over 5 million words. Several of his writings are included among the great literary classics of the Western world. If you went to University of California at Irvine or the University of California at Riverside, near where I live, and you were to take a classics degree, you would read a couple books by St. Augustine. So he's not just a Christian author. He's a classical author. And he's had a big influence in that area. Though Augustine lived in the latter stages of the ancient Roman Empire, we call that late antiquity, many of his theological, philosophical, ethical, and historical, and even political ideas are still prominent today. So even though he's been dead more than 1,000 years, a lot of his ideas are still present today. You come in contact with some of the things that he argued, some of the ideas that he thought was very important. Augustine was a versatile and intuitive Christian apologist. As an untiring and tenacious defender of Catholic or universal Orthodox Christianity, his doctrinal and apologetic writings in large part ensured that ancient Christianity, and here's where I'm looking at a future lecture talking about what I think Augustine's most important contribution is. He's defending the idea so that Christianity would remain a biblical religion of divine rescue and not degenerate into a humanistic religion of self-help salvation. I think you could make a case that Augustine's most influential teaching was we're saved by grace, and that motivated his entire theological thinking. His efforts, more than anyone else in the first 1,000 years of the Christian church, were responsible for setting forth a systematic understanding of the Christian world and life view. According to the ancient biblical scholar Jerome, a contemporary of Augustine, by the way, I might say that Jerome is considered the greatest ancient biblical scholar. And I've read the correspondence between Augustine and Jerome, and they would debate each other. They liked each other, but they were competitive with each other. And you can see sometimes the sarcasm between them. When Jerome would make a point biblically that differed with Augustine, Augustine would say something like, "Well, I'm just a lowly bishop, and you're the great biblical scholar, so who am I to challenge you?" So you see that kind of discussion that went between the two of them. One of the places where I think Jerome was right and Augustine was wrong is Jerome thought that the Apocrypha, right? Catholics have a heavier Bible than we do. You don't want to get into swinging your Bible with a Catholic because they've got more weight. They've got more books. Jerome thought that the apocryphal books of the Old Testament were not on the same level as the other books of the Bible. He saw them as a secondary canon. Augustine, I think, argued, and in my opinion, argued wrongly, that those books should be seen on the same level. So as an apologist, Augustine was universally admired in the church and, more importantly, hated by all the heretics. Augustine viewed this enmity for the enemies of Orthodox Christianity as a badge of honor. Augustine thought you had to fight for Christianity. Augustine thought you had to stand up for Christianity. And he thought that he lived at a time when it was very important that genuine Christian doctrine be affirmed and that false doctrine be opposed. Contemporary Christians and non-Christians alike should take note that one of the most influential thinkers in the entire history of the Western world was himself a devoted follower of Jesus Christ. I mean, if you were to go to a very secular school like UCLA, like UC Riverside, like University of California, Irvine, and you were to take a degree in literature, and you would be reading somebody who is seen as one of the most influential people of their time. But what I hope you would come away with is you're dealing with a real brother in Christ. That Augustine was a genuine follower of Jesus Christ. And that's an important statement to be made before the secular world, that Western civilization was deeply shaped by Christian thinkers like Augustine. So some of my friends say that they prefer Luther or Calvin or Aquinas over Augustine. But for me, I'd rather go to lunch with St. Augustine. And so I'm going to give you one of my best arguments why you should prefer Augustine over the other three. Augustine is the only philosopher theologian that both Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger sing about. Where do they sing about Calvin or Luther? I mean, we're talking about the classics here. Bob Dylan has a song entitled, "I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine." Now, I don't know how if he were what he had taken prior to that. I will tell you, however, that the Jagger Richards song, "Saint of Me," that came out a number of years ago, it's a very sophisticated theological song in which they talk about St. Augustine's conversion. So I got pop culture on my side, right? No Luther, Calvin, Aquinas here. And so here are two famous Augustinians for you. They're going to need to be saved by grace. I can tell you that. Well, let me address another question that somebody might be asking themselves. Sometimes people wonder why a Protestant like me would be interested in a Catholic saint, right? I had one fellow say to me one time, he said, "I want to tell you, Mr. Samples, that Augustine is a heretic." And I said, "Well, I'm okay with that as long as Augustine is still all right." Now, let me address that big debate. Do we pronounce his name Augustine or do we pronounce it Augustine? Well, he's named after two Roman emperors. His name is Aurelius Augustinus. So he's named after Augustus Caesar, and he is named after Marcus Aurelius. So he is born in a very Roman context and named after two Caesars. All I can tell you is this, it's okay to call him Augustine. I don't know any Augustine scholar who calls him that. I think the pronunciation is much to be preferred that we would call him Augustine. But I'm not going to get mad if you call him Augustine because I'm a person of grace, right? Here's what Michael Reeves says. This, by the way, is the author of that nice little book that I've been recommending, Delighting in the Trinity. Michael Reeves is an evangelical and in a public lecture had an interesting comment. By the way, I might also say, Reeves is one of the people that brings a strong criticism against Augustine that I hope to cover the last lecture night of our series. Here's what Michael Reeves says. He says, "The Reformation really is a debate within Augustine's mind." The Reformation really is a debate within Augustine's mind. What does that mean? Well, Benjamin Warfield, who I think is one of the great Reformed theologians of the 20th century, 19th and 20th century, Benjamin Warfield said that in his book, Calvin and Augustine, Warfield said that the Reformation could be reduced to two ideas. The Catholic Church had a very strong view of church authority. The Protestants were illegitimate. They were teenagers going through a rebellion. And Mother Church needed to exercise the authority and pulling the rug out from underneath them. Augustine did have a very strong view of the church. And if you were a heretic, the church is going to come down on you. Well, on the other hand, the Protestant represented Augustine's view of grace. And so Warfield is not the only one to say that maybe we could think about the Reformation as two very strong Augustinian ideas that clashed together. Now, let me say this. That's an exaggeration. That's definitely an exaggeration. The Reformation was a very complex event. But I think there's truth there. I think that there really is truth. Now, of course, what people want us to answer is, if Augustine had lived at the time of the Reformation, would he have become a Protestant? Would he have rejected the Roman Catholic Church and embraced the Protestant position. Well, that was asked of Philip Schaff, the great church historian, and Schaff said that he thought Augustine would have, his heart would have been with the Protestants, but he had too strong a tie to the unity of the church. So he would have started an evangelical reformation within Catholicism. Now, those are, again, difficult questions to answer, right? What would have happened if, kind of thinking about a different view of church history? But I think that's probably as good an answer as you may want to find. So this may be an exaggerated reduction, but several distinguished Protestant theologians over the centuries have proposed that the Reformation dispute within Western Christendom was in effect Augustine's view of the church, Roman Catholic, versus Augustine's view of grace, Protestant. In fact, there's an interesting quote I have here from Carl Truman. He is a church historian at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. He's a very charming person. And I like how he does church history. He's excited about it, and he draws people in. But this is what he had to say to a Roman Catholic apologist who asked him. The Roman Catholic apologist, and I'll give you the link if you'd like to look at it. It's very interesting. A Catholic apologist says, which of the Catholic saints do Protestants most like? And so this Catholic apologist decided to ask Carl Truman, well, who would that be? Who would that be? So here is Truman's response. I give the quotation to you in full. He says, the Princeton theologian B.B. Warfield once commented that the Reformation represented the triumph of Augustine's understanding of grace over his doctrine of the church. Like all such pithy sayings, it is something of an oversimplification, but it does contain significant truth. And here's a powerful quotation. This is Carl Truman. He says, Augustine is as important to Protestants as to Catholics. Now, if you're an Anglican and you're thoughtful and studied, you'd know that immediately. If you're Lutheran and studied, you'd know that to be true. If you're Reformed and you know something about church history, that would make a lot of sense to you. Now, non-denominational people don't know who St. Augustine is. But I think in many ways, theologically speaking, Protestants appeal to St. Augustine and Catholics appeal to them. And in some ways, they appeal to him to try to tell us who's right. I think that's really interesting. Now, Truman goes on. He says, his confessions help to shape Protestant understandings of the Christian inner spiritual conflict. You know, when Christians talk about spiritual formation, when our evangelical friends talk about doing things that will help you to grow spiritually, right? Some of that's in St. Augustine. So his confessions help to shape Protestant understandings of Christian inner spiritual conflict. His work on the Trinity was carried over into the Reformation with no significant alteration. Beyond a certain skepticism among some of his use of psychological analogies, and his work on predestination was fundamental to Protestant reading of the Apostle Paul. I've read Calvin's view of predestination, and I compared it to my reading of Augustine. I see no difference. I see no difference. Quite frankly, except for a little bit of a difference, I don't think Calvin and Augustine disagree all that much with Luther. And let me put one more. I don't know that Augustine and Calvin and Luther's view of election and predestination differs all that much from Thomas Aquinas. I know that there are many Christians that are troubled by the so-called double predestinarian views that come out of the Reformed camp. I can only tell you those ideas are deeply rooted in Christianity, and you also have to look at what Scripture says about those issues. So some of the great classical theologians, not just Augustine and not just Calvin, thought that God had predestined the elect. So a very interesting point of view. Now, Truman closes by saying this. He says, indeed, one could write a history of the Reformation as an extended debate over the interpretation of Augustine's works. And indeed, who owns him? Who owns them? Polemically, it was critical. Both sides needed him in order to establish key points of historical continuity with past teaching. Catholics are quoting Augustine. Protestants are quoting Augustine. They are looking at church history and saying, our view is correct. And we're quoting the heavyweight theologians to buttress that idea. Truman says, moving beyond the early Reformation, Augustine continued to be the most significant early church father in Reformed theology. Calvin uses him extensively, as do Bullinger and Vermigli. Then, as Reformed theology established itself within the university context in the later 16th and 17th centuries, Augustine continued to be a significant influence both directly through the primary texts and as mediated through the medieval scholastic theologians such as Thomas Bradwardine and Thomas Aquinas. And he closes with this. He says, put simply, the question he raised about Pauline interpretation and about grace, predestination and human agency, were hardly perennials for Protestants who had no desire either to reinvent the wheel in such areas, nor to innovate where no innovation was necessary. So Augustine, he casts a big shadow. And just as Catholics, I think, have legitimacy to quote him and to appeal to him to support their position, so Protestants do as well. That they feel and they can make a case that Augustine would have thought highly of the Protestant tradition. Okay, let's talk about his life a little bit, because he's a colorful individual. I mean, in some ways, Augustine is kind of like the Billy Graham examples. I mean, Augustine has this incredible conversion. I mean, he's kind of the rock star who gets convicted and gives up his evil life. It's a profound story, and so many things that we find in him, we see in kind of popular Christianity, kind of popular evangelical Christianity. So let's talk a little bit about some of the history, and then we'll talk about some of the ideas, and then we'll give a little time for questions and answers. So his name is Augustine. We call him St. Augustine of Hippo Regius there in North Africa. There are his dates, 354 to 430. His early life, we got to talk about his parents. He's born in a city called Tagaste, in a Roman province of Numidia in North Africa. We today would call it Sukara, south of Bone in Algeria. My father was a soldier in the Second World War, and my father initially was sent to North Africa, and he was stationed in Algeria. So that's right there in North Africa. That's his birthplace in Tagaste. A bit about his parents. His father was a pagan. Patricius, a small landowner. Apparently he was a gambler. He was a womanizer. He caused a lot of pain to Augustine's family. His mother is probably after Jesus' mother, one of the most important mothers in church history, Monica. She's a Christian. And she has a huge influence on Augustine. Augustine is a mama's boy. He doesn't know it right away, but he is. And she prays for him all of his life. She has a huge influence. In fact, there's a story about Monica that she became desperate, because she saw her son falling away from all of the Christian truth and values and involving himself in hedonism. And she went to the local bishop and she would cry and complain. And the story is that the bishop said, I know Augustine will return, because not even God can put up with your complaining. Now that might be a rough translation, but she loved her son. She loved her son. And How often we find families like this, right? We find families. I think we see here what I'm going to call later a dysfunctional family. Augustine's father doesn't pay a lot of attention to his kids. He's converted on his deathbed. Augustine is a smart kid, however, very, very bright, and he's given a classical education. For goodness sakes, he learns to read by reading the writings of Virgil. And he says that he prefers the Roman Virgil over the Greek Homer. He learns to speak by reading the words of Cicero. That's what we mean by a classical education. He comes out of that backdrop, and he's a very bright kid. And immediately, Augustine's parents realize, to be candid, he is our meal ticket. This is a kid that could become a lawyer. This is a kid that could have great success and care for the parents. And so Augustine is a real bright kid, although when he's young, he's not interested in learning. He talks about going to school and being beaten for not studying and not paying attention. So here is a painting of him. And maybe we could look a little bit here at the world in which Augustine lives. This is the Roman world. Notice that it includes in the north all the way up to Germania. It's the Visigoths, it's those German tribes that come down right at the time of Augustine's death, and they take hold of North Africa. So it's all the way up above Italy. Notice that it goes all the way over into England and all the way down into North Africa. And Carthage there is a seaport, and it's the Carthaginians that had the sea battles with the Romans. So there's a lot of history in that part of the world. And this is the Roman world. This is the Roman world. How about Augustine as an adult? Well, he's a bright bulb. So they send him away to the university. They send him to the big city. Tagaste is a small country area. They send him to Carthage, to the big city. And Augustine just forgets everything he's ever been taught about Christianity. He is attracted to hedonism. He's attracted to paganism. He almost immediately builds a relationship with a servant girl. Now, it's more than just kind of a tawdry affair. Augustine and this woman probably would be called a common law marriage. He's with her for 9 years. He loves her. But Augustine's attracted by the hedonism of the Roman world, and sexuality is a big part of that hedonistic world. He has a child with this young woman, and so he's barely out of his teens, and he's a young father. This boy, by the way, later becomes a Christian and is baptized with Augustine, dies prematurely. So Augustine walks away from all of the Christian influence that he got from his mother, Monica. Now, what about Augustine's ideas? Well, he's captivated. He's captivated by this classical Greco-Roman philosophy, this world of ideas. He's fascinated by it. He wants to become an attorney. In fact, at the peak of his influence, he's hoping he could actually work for Caesar himself, which would give him lots of money, lots of power. He's drawn by that. He's captivated by Cicero's Hortensius, and so he falls in love with the concept of wisdom, and he becomes a philosopher in a sense. Now, the book Hortensius is lost in antiquity. That's kind of a shame that we don't know the content of that book exactly. And in fact, while he was captivated by Cicero, he compared Cicero to the Bible. And he examined the scriptures but found them disappointing. In fact, he says in the Confessions, "To me they seemed quite unworthy of comparison with the stately prose of Cicero." He's kind of an intellectual snob. he kind of looks at his mother's Christianity as kind of fundamentalism. He's above all of that. He's beyond all of that, right? Here's a statue of the great Roman philosopher and orator Cicero. I can only tell you there's a lot to be attracted to in the Greco-Roman world. I mean, there's a reason why people take classical studies. Common grace, right, a very important doctrine in Reformed theology, says that people can be non-Christians and actually do some pretty good philosophy. People can be non-Christians and know a lot. Well, this Roman worldview has attracted Augustine and influenced him. Here's an interesting and personal quote. Again, thinking of having lunch with St. Augustine, David Nagel, who is a philosopher at a Baptist university in Dallas, and he's an Augustine scholar, he says this. He says, using current psychological jargon to describe his, Augustine's, background, a prima facie reading of his confession reveals that he grew up in a dysfunctional family, suffered through a childhood of unhappiness, was prone to theft and dishonesty, abhorred study and formal education, was virtually addicted to sex and food, enjoyed the life of the theater and the cabaret, studied offbeat philosophies and religions, and for a time was a single parent. His life was unquestionably disordered. And like many of our contemporaries, he found himself on a restless course in search of healing and happiness. You know, I ask myself, why do I like the Confessions? Why do I keep reading it? I mean, a lot of books I read and I put on the shelf, I've got it. I've got enough out of that. I can only tell you, I've read the Confessions more than a dozen times, and every time I read it, I see something new. Every time I read it, I feel, maybe it's my own narcissism, I feel like he's talking to me. I feel like he relates to me. In fact, some people have suggested that maybe Augustine is the first modern man. He talks about this longing that we have. You know, he's away from his mother's fundamentalist values. But he doesn't seem to be enjoying life. Having multiple sexual partners doesn't fulfill him. Having power over other people, he doesn't find it fulfilling. There's a deep sense in which Augustine is becoming disillusioned by this. Now, there's a reference there in Nagel that Augustine was a thief. Now, this, of course, relates to one of the great stories in the Confessions. When Augustine was a young man, he was in the hood. We would say that in the neighborhood I grew up in. And some of his criminal backpackers, right, they decide to descend on this guy's tree and pull the fruit off. And they're not interested in eating it. They just want to do it because it's illegal. You know, they like the thrill of doing something wrong. Wow, that's another reason I'd like to talk to Augustine at lunch. I'd like to ask him about those kinds of things. Let's look ahead a little bit. Now, I've talked about how brilliant Augustine is. He's so brilliant that he joins a cult. And he's so brilliant that he stays in it for 9 years. Well, I can only tell you that joining a cult or a false religion is not a matter of intelligence. He's looking, he's searching. He wants a worldview that can give him all of those things that he desires. So he joins the Manichaean religion, which is a strange religion. It's a religion that says there are two worlds. It's a dualist religion. There's the physical world, and then there's the spiritual world. And it says that the body is a bad thing. And it's based upon a religion by an individual named Mani, who thought he was the Holy Spirit, and he was killed because of that. Well, Augustine has all of these strange ideas, and I think he I think he likes it in many ways because it's kind of where he is, where he's at. What is his problems with Christianity? Because he soon begins to realize that Christianity is a bit more formidable than he thought. And here is his problems with Christianity. They're threefold. He's troubled by the idea that God is an immaterial, non-physical being. Maybe it's the Manichaeanism, right? And he's not quite sure how does all of this work out. He's also troubled because he thinks God created evil. Augustine has a problem. The problem is the problem of evil. Do you know how many people I've known in my life who have religious problems, who have problems with Christianity because of the problem of pain and suffering and evil? I mean, these are, when I drive home from church and I drive by the Chalk Hospital, I have a problem with the problem of pain and suffering. When I see kids with cancer, I think, Lord, how can this be? If I care so much for these kids, I know you care more. What's wrong with the world? Augustine's troubled by that. He thinks the Christian God is essentially the God who created evil. And he thinks that Christians are all faith and no reason. They're all belief, no rationality. So he has some misperceptions. Now, while all of this is going on, he is moving ahead in his teaching career. He wants to be a rhetorician. He wants to be someone who would be in the courts persuading people. He's an expert at persuasion. He's an expert at rhetoric. You could see that in the Confessions, the way he words things, the way he uses words. He's a wordsmith. And so he first teaches in Tagaste, then he goes to Carthage, and he thinks the students in Carthage are kind of hard to control. They're unruly. Then he moves to Rome, and the students in Rome are very well behaved, but they have this strange setup where you don't pay your tuition until the class is over. And the Romans will take the course, and then they'll split. And he thinks, finally, he's given kind of his dream job. He's given a position in Milan, where essentially he's not many steps away from working for Caesar. I mean, he has now arrived. He's got a great salary. He's got a lot of esteem. He's kind of in the time of his career where everything is coming to a fulfillment. And he has a deep sense now of skepticism. He's tried Manichaeanism. He's tried all of these things. And he begins reading philosophy. In fact, he's influenced by what we would call Neoplatonism. And he likes some of the Platonic ideas. In fact, these are the early ideas that he's later going to shape in a Christian way. And I might also say, I'll just tell you what the biggest criticism of Augustine is, that he's largely a Platonist. He's bringing his Greek philosophy in, and it's not Scripture that is the authority for him. It's his Greek way of thinking. So the last lecture, I'll try to address that, and we'll see where we can come down on this. Well, the great Neoplatonic thinker is Plotinus. And Plotinus has a big influence on St. Augustine. Let's jump now to his conversion. He's troubled. He has these longings. He's accomplished a lot in his life, and he doesn't feel deeply fulfilled, deeply satisfied. And he's there in Milan, and who is the bishop of Milan? St. Ambrose. Now, Ambrose is known in church history as the greatest preacher in church history, great orator. So Augustine goes to his church not because he's interested in the gospel, not because he's interested in Christianity, but Augustine's always looking out for people who know how to speak. He's thinking, maybe Ambrose probably isn't as good as me. So he goes to listen to him, and he keeps coming back, and he keeps coming back. And he'll ask questions of Ambrose, and Ambrose will say, "We Catholic Christians don't believe that." And so they develop this relationship with each other, and he's exposed to the New Testament. And he has a big influence. And all of that, over a number of years, leads to what is called his garden experience. Now again, this is kind of like evangelicals. He's now at a stage where he's studying Scripture regularly. And he has this kind of intellectual Christian influence through Ambrose. And he's thought a lot about death. One of his close friends died. And he's reading the biblical text. He's reading the book of Romans. And he has a strange experience. He hears what sounds like a child's voice. And in Latin it says, tole lege, take up and read, take up and read. So he's looking around, you know, where'd this voice come from? And he is there with Alpius, his close friend, and they conclude that this is a voice sent by God. And he's reading the biblical text, and this is kind of that conversion experience, and his life is kind of pitched upside down. And on Easter, AD 387, he's baptized by Ambrose, him and his son, and a number of his friends. So Augustine is kind of like the gangster or the rock musician or the influential guy that has this real change, radical change in his life. He returns to North Africa, partly because he wants to go back to his roots, partly because he's not a healthy man. He has some kind of lung problem. And maybe going back to the air that is hot and dry, that might help him. So he goes back to North Africa. He doesn't want to be a priest. He doesn't want to be a bishop. He wants to study. He wants to read. But his reputation, you know, this great scholar has now had this radical conversion to Christianity. The church knows about it. And they pester him, and the bishop comes to him and says, you would be unfaithful to God if you didn't accept a position of leadership. So he's ordained a priest, and then later the bishop, upon his death, says, Augustine, you're the most qualified person to become bishop. And so he does. Now, Augustine dies in 430. This is a great story. He has servants, of course. He's a bishop. And he's on his deathbed, and Augustine's favorite Old Testament book is Psalms. And he has his servants write on the ceiling the penitential Psalms, so that is that he's laying on his deathbed, he can be conversing with God. He can be reading God's word. And that's how he dies. At the same time, politically, it looks like the Roman Empire is coming apart. The Vandals are besieging the city of Hippo. These are the Germanic tribes. And when they take Hippo, they don't burn his library. He had an extensive library, and they don't, because he even had a very strong reputation, even with non-Christians. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of his ideas. His writings, in many ways, are the foundation for philosophy and theology. We've already said that he's a prolific classical and Christian author, 5 million words. I don't know how he did that, given the time that he lived in. What are some of his most important works? In another lecture, I'm going to pick one of those and tell you which of those I think is the most important. But all of you know about the Confessions, and I'm sure just as many know about the City of God. He has a great and influential book on the Trinity. On Christian Doctrine is kind of like a systematic theology, if you will, touching upon them. I want to say just a couple things about the Confessions, because I'm gonna devote some time later. This is a new kind of book. It's a new genre. There's no autobiographies written at that time. Certainly there's no spiritual autobiographies written at that time. Now you go into a Christian bookstore, it's filled with books like that, right? He creates a new genre. And Confessions, I think, can be understood in three ways. It's his confession of sin, and he has a lot of sin. I don't know exactly if we would say he had a sexual addiction, but if there is such a thing, he had it. He was a worldly individual. And so he has a lot of sin to confess. And in fact, because in his later life he is such a holy individual, he would never, after becoming a priest, he would never be in a room alone with a woman. He wouldn't allow that to happen. He becomes such a saintly figure that in some ways people think that he writes the confessions to say, you know, I'm just like you. I'm just like you. It's also a confession of faith, right? You not only confess your sins, but you confess your newfound faith. And I think it's a great confession to God for his grace, that Augustine knows that he's been saved by grace, that God's love and God's forgiveness comes to him, and it's not merited. It's not merited. I think Augustine struggles with what I struggle with and maybe what you struggle with. There are times I think about grace and I think about the idea that salvation is something I don't deserve. And work as hard as I can, I could never earn it. And yet it's been given to me. And you know what? That bothers me. I have to come to grips with that. And I have to keep my eye on the idea that I'm saved by grace. And so Augustine has, a triple sense there. Here are two of his books. I like the Penguin Classic editions. Not only are they less expensive as some of the others, but I like some of the translations. I like the Pine Coffin Penguin Classic edition of the Confessions. There is another version that's come out recently, translated by a Catholic scholar. I think it has a lot of merit. I know that Pastor Riddlebauger likes it, and I'll talk about it a little bit later. The City of God, these are books you can buy. These are books you can read. You can think through. The Confessions is really, it's probably some of the things you don't like about evangelicalism. It's kind of a spiritual, psychological self-analysis. But instead of kind of psychological theories, I think it's Augustine looking into his own life in light of the Bible. I actually think psychology is a very critical area of study. And I think probably Augustine does psychology well. He looks at the sinful human condition. He looks at his inabilities. And it's suffused with philosophy and theology and stories from his life. And some people read it because they love the devotional literature. He also has some very technical apologetic writings. Notice the ancient against the Manichaeans, against the Donatists, against Pelagius and Calistius, against the academics. He's essentially critiquing all of the belief systems that he at one point held. He's now turned apologist and showing why he doesn't hold those things and why those other philosophies of life are inadequate. Why historic Christianity, why Catholic Christianity is the true faith. He has, even though he's not a philosopher, technically, he has a lot of contributions, and I'm just going to tick them off. I'll maybe touch on one a little bit later. I would say his 10 contributions to philosophy has a powerful view of the theory of time. In fact, I think it's better than what most Christian theologians who are deeply educated philosophers have to say today. He talks about learning language, how children learn, how they think. His apologetic, faith-seeking understanding, how does faith and reason come together? Anselm picks up that idea. He has an ontological argument long before the ontological argument becomes popular. He has a refutation of skepticism. He has a belief in the existence of God from eternal truths. I think when John Frame and Greg Bahnsen talk about God as this transcendental reality, there's a lot of Augustine in there. He has a theory about the problem of evil. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but essentially, he thinks that evil's like a parasite. It's like a cavity in your tooth. It's not a thing. And essentially, his response is, you got to have a host that the parasite can live on. You have to have a standard of goodness by which evil can transgress. And that's a very popular argument today. He has a view of a divine illumination, his view of creation ex nihilo. In fact, how many of you are familiar with the famous cosmologist Paul Davies? Anybody? Paul Davies, I think, is a deeply insightful scientist who's a little frustrating because he seems to come right next to theism and then steps back. But Paul Davies was on a podcast, and he said, I was reading Augustine the other day. When I heard that, I almost hit the car in front of me. I thought, what's Paul Davies reading St. Augustine? And Davies was saying something to the effect that he was intrigued that Augustine's idea of creation ex nihilo was very similar to the way modern cosmologists think of the universe. I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. The examined self. Augustine has a lot to say about psychology. And by the way, I know that there's a lot of psychology that's unbiblical, but I think the psychology that's good is the biblical psychology. Christianity talks a lot about the self. Christianity talks a lot about the human condition, the human predicament. Something's gone fundamentally wrong. And so Augustine is kind of a modern individual. So if you went into the Barnes and Noble of the time, there'd be no autobiographies. He creates the new area. Let me close with this, and we'll have some time for some questions. Consider what the Oxford History of Western Philosophy says about St. Augustine. This is pretty heavy reading here, the Oxford History of Western Philosophy. But notice what they say about Augustine. They say it is arguable that Augustine is the most influential philosopher who ever lived. His authority has been felt much more broadly and for a much longer time than Aristotle's, whose role in the Middle Ages was comparatively minor until rather late. As for Plato, for a long time, much of his influence was felt mainly through the writings of Augustine. Again, that question, how much of Augustine is really kind of Greek philosophy? How much of it is authentic biblical Christianity? Well, hold on, and we'll come to that a little later. They continue, for more than a millennium after his death, Augustine was an authority who simply had to be accommodated. He shaped medieval thought as no one else did. Moreover, his influence did not end in the Middle Ages. Throughout the Reformation, appeals to Augustine's authority were commonplace on all sides. Now, this is a secular text. This is a secular analysis. His theory of illumination lives on in Malbrook, and in Descartes' Light of Nature. His approach to the problem of evil and to human free will is still widely held today. His force was and is still felt not just in philosophy, but also in theology, popular religion, and political thought, for example, in the theory of just war. Well, let me stop there. And in the successive lectures, we'll take some of these ideas and we'll see what Augustine might have said and whether we can agree with him or whether we might disagree with him. So